You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 54 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Matilda Siebrecht, and you know what? We were just talking about how I can't pronounce my guest's name and then I just completely mispronounce my own blooming last name. I'm Matilda Siebrecht. This is part two of our Tea Break with Katie Chin Kui, talking all about ancient, for want of a better term, self-care. So we talked a little bit last episode about the kind of the general research framework around it and how it's been approached archaeologically and all of this kind of stuff. This time we're going to get more into the nitty gritty of it. And because the way that I first discovered this topic and your interest in it was through an experimental archaeology video that you had done with this. So how, of course, there's archaeological evidence for things we find, but how do we know about these, I guess, recipes, are they, that we find for these sorts of things?
Yeah, there are recipes. So we do have ancient written sources. And then we also, because people, you know, archaeologists find these creams and then they take it to the lab and then we can identify exactly what is in there. We're able to recreate these things if you want to. Now, I will say just as a little note.
Do we need to don't try this at home?
Right, yeah, exactly. I do a lot of research on these ingredients before I put it on my face. And also being a nurse practitioner and able to sort of look into medical texts, I have still access to a whole bunch of stuff. I feel like that gives me a unique safety stamp there. So yeah. This is, and also I think that's part of experimental archaeology, is what can we take from the past that maybe we shouldn't be using now, but we can translate to try to find an analog there.
Yeah.
Okay. Which I'm sure as an experimental archaeologist yourself, you know all about that.
It's, yeah. And there's also, I guess, those certain, there might be some ingredients that we don't even know that they're, I don't know, unsafe or something until you then have applied it to your skin and then you're like, oh, this is burning.
Yeah, this is a little too peeling. So as far as the written sources, we have, I think most people think of ancient Rome first. And I mean, Ovid wrote the Medicamina and Cosmetic. We have five recipes from Ovid, and that's one of the ones that I did, and that was super fun. And then we have Galen also wrote on medicine and humors. That was sort of the big thing. And that also has to do a lot with skin. So sort of how the Roman sort of concept of beauty and skin, a lot had to do with if your skin is looking good on the outside, this is sort of the humorous concept, then your internal body must be good as well, which is not wrong.
Well, I mean, and that's not wrong at all. Yeah.
I mean, like 100%, they were onto something. But ancient Egypt, really, we have a significant amount from written from ancient Egypt. So Ebers Papyrus, and we're talking about around 1550 BCE, although it probably contained information, you know, from much further back, but that's when that's the dating of that. That's the richest sort of single source that we have. It's referred to as a medical text, but it spans cosmetics. There's about, I think it's like number 714, 15, 16, 17, something like that. If you want to look it up yourself, it's really fun. And the recipes are there. It often contains honey. That was a big ingredient in the ancient world, certainly in Egypt.
This has just reminded me of my teenage self looking up. I had not acne, but I just at some point had very greasy skin as a teenager.
Sure.
Hated it. Standard. I was also at the time living in Australia as like a pale redheaded girl. So I was surrounded by all of these beautiful bronzed, you know, people. Yeah. And I'm there being like, and you know, so it highlights the red patchy spottiness of your face. And I was like, okay, I want to deal with this. And I didn't want to use, I don't know, I was using things. And then I was like, let's look up natural things. And I looked up honey and saw that honey was supposed to be really good for that and really good for your skin. So I would lie on the sofa with like a tea towel around me and just have like, you know, the squeezy honeys, like,
yes.
Just like squeeze that on my face. And I can still remember my dad just walking in being like, what on doing? It's like, it's for my skin, dad.
First experimental archaeology moments.
Oh my gosh. That was me.
Well, that's great. love that for you. The bigger question is, did it do anything?
I like to think it did. It made me feel fresher.
Okay.
I mean,
I don't know. Honey as an ingredient has antimicrobial and anti-inflammatory properties. I mean, antimicrobial, that's a biggest one. And so,
maybe did help. I mean, I also have now, there's all sorts of honey scrubs and things that you can get. So honey lip balm.
Yeah, this is a whole, we can get to that sort of how these are basically the same ingredients that we've been using forever. Like it hasn't really changed a ton. But the other written source I was going to say is from ancient China. And that's the, I don't speak Mandarin as we have established, but it's from the Wushi Bingfang, which is recipes for 52 ailments. Oh. And that was copied around 215 BCE, they think, but it was found in this 215. Yeah, it was found sealed in a 168 BCE tomb, but it was probably older than that. And that's really more dermatological.
Okay.
But it just goes to show you, like, no matter what, like I was saying before, this is not new. People have skin. People know they have skin. People know they have to protect skin. This is in no way is this new. You know, this is just us sort of looking at it from this archaeological perspective is new, but I think that's also what makes it so exciting personally. Well,
and also I can imagine, so this is just going on my own thing from when I did an episode about the archaeology of tea and then trying to find like written sources for things. But then of course you have archaeological evidence for stuff much older, but then of course people only start writing about it later on. When writing gets invented, for want of a better word, or at some point they're like, oh, this is quite interesting and we've been doing this for a long time, we should probably write it down. I can imagine it's the same with things like skincare.
I think you're exactly right. That's probably what happened.
But like, so the oldest, we mentioned it, I'm so sorry, as an archaeologist you'd think that I'd be good at dates. Unfortunately, dates, names, anything like that just fly in one ear and go completely out the other. So oldest sort of archaeological evidence versus historic written evidence for these kind of things, is there a disparity there?
Well, like I said, the intact what we think is a skin cream that was from ancient China. That was 2,700 years old. Okay. So that's that's sort of the biggest, you know, intact thing that we have. Now, when we're talking about sort of items and, like I said, sort of like artifactual evidence and object, that gets a little bit more complicated without a product that we can do a residue analysis on. So I think, again, that's why this is so understudied. And I think there's a lot of room to grow here.
Okay. And then, so we've talked about the ancient Egyptian record of it. There's an ancient Chinese record of it. Are those secure, those descriptions? Like, is it pretty clear that they are referring to something skincare-esque?
I mean, the Ebers Papyrus, for sure. The Ebers Papyrus has recipes or spell, you know, this is I think what's really interesting about it is because some of these ingredients are also associated with some ritual, some mythology, some magic. So there's a thin line between magic and ritual, medicine, and, you know, this is my sweet spot kind of, and as far as like my interest goes. But the Ebers Papyrus, those are super duper clear. It says like for wrinkles or for the beautification of the skin. It actually doesn't say wrinkles. It says for skin folds. So we're not quite sure. Oh, but that's nice. Probably
we should just call them that now.
Yeah, exactly.
You're looking a bit skin foldy.
Like a Sharpay. So yeah. And then Ovid, that's really clear. I mean, in the Medica Mina, it says like these are the recipes for, this is a recipe for skincare. The other one that I did the experimental archaeology on was, and I've done two face masks with my friend Maisie, who's also an archaeologist, and it's just been like a hoot. And I'm like, how can I host like a retreat where we just do this? This is so much fun.
Yes. I mean, I think, that sounds like the next loop of the career path to me.
Oh my God. I just think I would love to do that and just sort of have the most fun sort of pampering, you know, like via the archaeological
perspective.
Stay tuned if anyone wants to sponsor that. So the Scythian one, which was distinctly different because it used green material, and that one we use cypress and cedar, but so that was from Herodotus. So we have these ancient sources that you have, you know, who is writing this and why? Yeah. These are the things that you need to ask. Like, do we take Herodotus as gospel truth? Obviously not. Is it a really great starting point to start to explore some of these things? Yes, of course. Yeah. It's a great starting point.
Yeah. Okay. And what are some of the favorite recipes or experiments that you yourself have trialed? What's gone well? What hasn't gone well?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're amazingly all really good. I mean, like, okay. I feel like I my skin is glowing after these. And but again, that's because these properties.
It's because of the radium, probably. That's
it's there. Probably, it's the lead, yeah. Lead was a thing that was used particularly in Roman ingredients. So that, yeah. That's where you have to sort of be careful about recreating things exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, like, these ingredients are still what we use now. So
yeah.
Barley and oats, those two, they are a beta glucan, and that has all sorts of properties that are used today. The face cream that I put on today was colloidal oatmeal. Like Aveeno, if you've heard of that brand, their entire brand is sort of based on that. And people have been doing that forever. Oh. Honey is still widely used, you know, everywhere.
It's fantastic.
Heard it here first. Yeah. I mean, the other things that may seem like a little more complicated or not as accessible, natron, which is salt, or sodium carbonate. Like, you might, calcium carbonate. Oh, the sodium carbonate, same thing too. But calcium carbonate is actually everywhere. So it's in chalk, it's limestone, yeah. It's in eggshells. So people would have not known that it was calcium carbonate, but they know that it has a mattifying effect. So mattifying, for your listeners that do not know that, you like sort of how what you were talking about, you felt like you had like greasy, oily skin or whatever, and you want to reduce that. So that's what something like, so it's basically powder, you know, when we think about like a compact and powder.
Eggshells, people, you say. I have chickens. Yeah. I think I feel part two of my experiment.
I mean, girl, all you got to do is grind that up, and you know, so people would put that into a carrier. So for a cream, so there's I don't know how deep you want me to get into the experimental archaeology part of this, into the experiment, but
always.
Yeah. So essentially you have things in the ancient past, what you're thinking about is taking raw materials, grinding them down, and then you need to add, you can't just put that on your face, it doesn't stay, right? So you need a carrier. This would have been an oil or a fat. It has to be probably fat-based, or for example, with the Ovid, the ancient Roman skincare mask that we did, the Ovid one, it called for barley water. Now, when you're using written sources, you sort of have to be, again, this is where you have to do a lot of research. There's a lot of research to do each of these because you kind of, there's some translation issues as well. So what does barley water mean? What I did was boil barley for like an hour, let that cool down, and then it becomes kind of viscous.
Oh, and like a jelly kind of, or?
I wish it was jellier, but there's tackiness to it. There's a tackiness to it. Yeah, it's a little thicker. And then you add that into your ground powder, and that is your carrier. So you have to, so those are just kind of two basic elements, and that more or less is the same now. I'm sure if any like cosmetic chemists are listening to me, I'm sure they're just like, it's way more complicated. Obviously, there's a lot more going on today.
We're just an archaeology podcast, guys. Chill down.
Yeah, don't quote me on that. But more or less, like, obviously, there are also powders that we use, straight up powders. You know, like, think about, like, the old school CoverGirl sort of compact or any kind of loose powder. And that is, like, a calcium carbonate, basically. That's just sort of ground up. Put some color in there. It's mica. But that is essentially what it is. So...
But yeah, also I find it kind of hilarious though, when I must admit, when you first said carrier, I was thinking of like little perfume bottle, like little, like a bag.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, carrier. Yeah, that's interesting. The material culture of like, of things. And then you're talking about, I was like, all right, yeah, you can tell that I do a lot of it.
Sure, of course.
It's good stuff. But that's actually something interesting as well, is the tools that you use, I don't know, for like application or for storage or things like that. How is that, how well known is that side of it?
Oh my gosh. I mean, that's a lot better known. I mean, obviously. So an ancient Egypt, once again, is a wealth of material culture. I mean, any museum collection anywhere is going to have a multitude of cosmetic, fragrance, and basically skincare sort of within the cosmetic realm, material culture from ancient Egypt. I mean, that was just, there were lots of coal pots. And of course, once again, I keep getting distracted by this because I'm trying to hit this point home really hard, and I apologize for this, but
that's fine.
That line between medicine and skincare is very thin and very blurred. So the coal that was used on the eyes in ancient Egypt had tons of medicinal properties, and there was a lot of, you know, sort of scientific reasoning for that. Maybe not the science that they were focused on. They just knew that if they did this, then this outcome happened, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, but a great thing from ancient Egypt is these makeup, these grinding palettes. So the palettes, this is really famous. I mean, there's a really famous one called the Narmer palette. So that was probably more ritual. It probably wasn't used, or maybe it was used once for a very specific ritual purpose.
Right. Okay.
Or actually even a state purpose. But the, you know, there were sort of these smaller ones, even sort of like pre-dynastic ones. So then you're sort of asking, you're starting to ask questions about timeline. You were asking before about like how far back do we go? If we're looking at pre-dynastic, I mean, then we're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago.
Okay. I was about to say, you're speaking to North European archaeologist. Okay.
So the dynasties, that's like pharaonic Egypt, right? So we're talking pre-pharaohs.
Got it.
And this is where they would grind, you know, grind that raw material up.
Yeah.
There's also these little spoons. They're really cool looking. They're decorated teeny tiny little spoons that would ostensibly, I think that like is makes perfect sense for some sort of skin care formulation, some sort of cream based formulation that they would have put on their face. So we even have that today, like in modern skin, we have these tiny scoops. That's when, how you know it's a really fancy brand, if you get a little scoop with it.
You know. Okay. Oh gosh. So they even had accessories, they had recipes, they had
loads.
Things, they had accessories. I mean,
yeah, loads.
They've been doing this for a long time. Well,
yeah. And like all these things have to be contained in like little jars and cute things. And of course these were decorated. Now I will say this is what we're talking about is all sorts of elite practices, right?
So okay.
I absolutely believe that the plebs and the you know, just average people were putting things on their skin, again, because it is an organ and because you need to protect your skin, and people would have figured something out. You know, when we're talking about sort of some of this other stuff, especially in ancient Egypt with all the accoutrements, you know, that we are talking elite, right?
Okay.
We're talking about elite experiences, elite.
Although it sounds indeed like the majority of the ingredients probably could have, it wasn't that the ingredients themselves were like elite products. It was the sort of finished things, but.
Right.
So,
it wasn't gold dust or diamond dust. You know, it was like honey, and like you could just be a normal person and be like, oh my gosh, my skin is so inflamed. I'm going to grab some honey, pop it on my skin.
Okay. Which is then interesting because you wonder whether it would have been indeed like the people getting the like cheap brand honey, the like leftover bits that they're scraping from the combs, like, and putting it into the drips and trying to see if there's a, that would be an interesting experiment to see if there's differences in the different, the elite versus the like plebeian.
Yeah. It's probably like, did someone put it through a sieve or did you just put some wax on your skin a little bit? Yeah.
Oh, we could do that. I don't mind being the pleb. I'll be the pleb. I'll just wipe a bee on my face and see what happens.
Good luck with that. Report back.
Yeah. Maybe I might need some more anti-inflammatory stuff after that happens. Well, we're going to take a very quick break to top up our teacups, but we will be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I hope that your teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. I actually really want some biscuits now. I've realized that I don't have any cookies left in the house and I need to. I only have the like kiddie sugar-free biscuits, which they're my like real last resort at like late at night when the kids are in bed. And I'm like, I just need something. I'm like, let's have these lovely sugar-free biscuits. I hope that they haven't counted them.
Oh, gosh.
So thank you so much, by the way, Katie, for sharing all of this amazing experience. I now have this whole new sphere of research that I'm curious to do a deep dive on at some point. But you're also about to start another twisty turny curve of your career path because you're about to start a PhD, which is very exciting. But the PhD,
that's why my job is student. That's the safest thing, is just lifetime student.
Keep finding new things to do. But so just out of curiosity, what is your PhD topic? How did that come about?
Yeah, so it's not ancient skincare. That's sort of my pet project, and it's super fun. But my PhD research kind of sits at a rather timely intersection. It's sort of Arctic archaeology and indigenous sovereignty, climate change, and tourism. So it's sort of all of those things. It seems like a far cry from what I do as a public archaeologist, but it actually brings together like a lot much larger parts of my life.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it also requires a lot of indeed communication and interaction. And
yeah. Oh, yeah. Able to
make things transparent and things like that. Okay. Well, very exciting. Yeah. And you start this year?
Yeah. Yeah. Start in September in Canada. So we have I'll be going to Western University in London, Ontario. So we have a very big move in about 8 weeks. So.
Okay.
Oh, pray to all the gods for me.
Yeah. Well, best of luck with the move and with starting that. But indeed, it's really interesting to see, and this is one of the things that I like to show through this podcast, the listeners have probably gathered, is how many different things you can do in archaeology. And also something that's your main, maybe like paid day job, like a PhD, isn't necessarily the thing that you're going to continue doing afterwards, or isn't necessarily something that is kind of continuing on. So in terms of the kind of the science communication side of things and that aspect, is that something you're hoping to continue with the PhD? Are you sort of aiming in?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to continue my platforms. It might be a little bit more sort of study tips or like day in a life of a PhD, but I really want to continue to explore different topics because that is what is fun. I think especially in academia, and this is where maybe I've struggled a bit, is because you're really sort of rewarded for studying, you know, this set of 10 coins for your entire career. And you are the world time immemorial expert on these 10 coins. And that's sort of the traditional approach to academia. And that's what people have been doing. And I think then it can get a little complicated if you have a lot of research interests. I think it can be really great as well, but if you are looking at the traditional trajectory for academia. But yeah, I mean, I have tons of interests and that's not really going to stop. And so so having sort of an outlet to be able to do that and to share with people, I really am excited by that and really want to continue that.
Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting you talk about that because I mean, I started doing this podcast, for example, and science communication while I was doing my PhD. And that's sort of how I got into it. I also had a journalism degree, so that's where it came in. And it's always interesting to chat to my colleagues. I remember talking about that and talking about trying to, and I mean, obviously, social media outreach is also a bit of a different thing too. Like there's so many different ways that you can do outreach and things like that. But you started your platforms while you were, you know, established in various careers in different things. Yeah. And you mentioned during COVID and things. So, I mean, how have you personally managed to kind of find that balance of sort of the professionalism, the communication, balancing those different parts of your life?
Yeah. I mean, I think I really didn't I didn't really like start the platforms until I was sort of like done with the degrees just because that was, I just couldn't like conceive of that. So obviously I haven't figured out how to balance things. But right now I think I've actually pulled back a lot on posting because initially I was like, I have to stay on top of this and I have to do more and I have to. And now I'm just like, nah, I got to live life. And if I really am inspired to do something, or if the world is happening in a certain way, I did a really big post on Greenland and that kind of got a lot of attention on various platforms. And that, now I'm not like a star, so when I say a lot of attention, like take that with a grain of salt, okay? So but it got a lot of engagement, let's say, and that was really exciting to see. And so I think that keeping social media in perspective too, making it work for your life as well, and not just making content for the sake of content. I think that is really important to sort of hold that as your North Star so that you are putting out quality content. It's really important to me. I mean, especially as someone who is about to start a PhD and looking to publish things, it's really important that the things that I create, at least for social media, stand up source wise and ethics wise, and just that I can really get behind it.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. And in terms of, so yeah, the PhD and the sort of future journey and everything, your topic that you're looking into, I guess that would involve a lot of interaction and communication with indigenous stakeholders. And
yeah. Yeah. So kind of like true community archaeology. Again, like my first job was on the Navajo Nation, and then I subsequently worked with various indigenous communities after that in Minnesota and California. And I think that experience gave me something that I don't think I could have really gotten any other way, which is just like a very real understanding of what it means to work with a community that has deep and sometimes ancient roots, you know, living descendant communities. This is this big difference between archaeology schooling and training in the Americas versus in Europe, is that people probably notice that archaeology departments are tucked under anthropology departments. And that's because you can't really separate those two. And I think that's a really good thing, and you shouldn't. But yeah, there's a lot of ethics, there's a lot of relationships, and there's a lot of trust that has to be built before any kind of deep research happens. And I think that's hugely important. And I think that maybe that's, I'm going into our next question, I think here. I think that's sort of what you can bring as a mature student. To appear.
Yes, that was what I was going to ask you. She's a redhead strip, ladies and gentlemen. Usually the guests just ignore the points that I send them as discussion points. It's so nice to hear that someone's
actually That was actually a magical transition I didn't plan.
That was beautiful. So. Wonderful segue. Indeed. So although we wouldn't know it to look at you, because of course you have all this amazing ancient skincare routine that you do. So, you know, glowing skin. But you are indeed a more mature student, shall we say, because you've had so much experience in all these different parts of life, right? Looking back, would you have changed anything that you did in your previous career paths, in your previous ways, based on what you know now?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, there's part of me for sure, you know, that I see like the undergrads and these younger graduate students who are totally able to go on these amazing digs, and they're like, I'm just gonna go to Greece for a few weeks and like, or go to Cyprus. And I'm just like, oh gosh, like that is something that really calls me a lot. And it's, but you know, my children, I have two children and they're very small. And it's just, yeah, it's just, it's, you can't live that sort of roaming, adventurous archaeologist life. I think the irony that my platform is Indiana.Joan is sort of my my call to that, but like my archaeology is distinctly a library archaeology. I hate to say that, but yeah, that's just not my season, and that's okay. I've kind of had to let that go. I mean, there will be digs and excavations in my future for sure. Yeah. There has to be, for one. I mean, that's a part of what doing a PhD is. But yeah, so in some ways, you know, sometimes I look back and I'm just like, oh man, like I see these undergraduate students and I'm like, you're living your best life. Like, I wish I would have come to archaeology earlier.
Yeah.
But then also like the things that I'm interested in and the things that I'm studying now, I just wouldn't have done that. You know, you're just, who knows? It's really hard to look back and see, you know, kind of think about the butterfly effect and what would have changed. But I don't know. I'm happy. I think overall I'm happy being in my 40s studying this.
Ladies and gentlemen, wouldn't know.
I think it gives me a really unique perspective, and I've mostly been really thankful for it.
Yeah. And what would you say is kind of the main thing that you think gives you, I guess, the edge over potentially younger people coming into a PhD based on the experience that you've had so far?
Time management, man. Mm. I mean, I challenge you to find a mature student who is not working at least 2 weeks ahead, because you have no wiggle room. So there's this constant fear that there is a constant fear with parents that your child is going to get sick, and all of your time is then gone for an undisclosed amount of time.
Yeah.
And so I remember that was like actually my main anxiety during school, was I was just like, okay, have they released the assignment yet? Like, I got to get on this. I got to start this, because like, you know, there's only 4 weeks left and whatever. So yeah, I mean, I think if I would have been able to apply sort of approaching your studies as a 9-to-5 job, if I would have been able to do that with my very first master's, you know, or my undergraduate degree, like I could have taken on the world. So that is the secret, ladies and gentlemen. Like, if you are able to treat, you know, sort of when I start my PhD, you know, this in September, that will be banker's hours. I will keep banker's hours, and you work from 9 to 5 and you just treat that like a job. That did not happen in my undergrad, I can assure you.
There was some, I saw some reel come by, speaking of social media, the other day, which was like, I took a PhD so that I don't have to work at 9 till 5. Now I work 24/7.
But because so would that be... You get home and then you start working as a parent.
If that's... you're interested in it as well, I guess that's a problem. Well, that was actually the nice thing. I always tell this about people when they're like, how did you manage to do a PhD with like 2 kids and, you know, all these other things going on? And I was like, well, luckily, my husband was doing a PhD at the same time, and he is very much in the mentality of like, no, this is a job. Like, my PhD is a job. Yeah, sure, I'm getting something at the end of it, but it's a job. I'm getting paid for a particular thing, and I need, as long as I do that thing, I'm keeping working hours. So he was very much like, no, end of the day now, I'm going to go off and do some gardening and everything. And now he's a full-time gardener, so that shows you how well the PhD went. But and that really helped me put things into perspective, because I think otherwise I definitely would have been the kind of person to be like, but no, I need to look up this other thing and go down this other rabbit hole and do this. And at the end of the day, a PhD is a training program.
It's a training program. And I use like all the tricks. I use the Pomodoro method. I use all the tricks to just like... stay focused and to like get done what I can get done in a day. I think that there's no way I would have done that in undergrad. I mean, there's just too many things going on. There's so many other things that you should be involved in, you can be involved in. Dating and all those things. I think for sure, like any adult, no matter what you studied before or what you did, any adult that is considered a mature student you're bringing in transferable skills. They may not be very clear, but whether or not that leads to a job at the end of it, just like you were saying with your husband. I mean, you may catch me behind the Sephora counter in 4 years. So, you know, who knows?
You'll be running the historic workshop at the Sephora counter.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess that leads nicely into the next question indeed is, so obviously you're about to start a PhD. I know from experience at the start of the PhD, you definitely don't want to be asked what's next, because you know. But do you have any sort of, I don't know, exciting plans or things coming up or kind of goals or directions in your various other pies that you have your fingers in?
I mean, I think trying to dive a lot deeper into the skincare experimental archaeology, that every single experiment takes a really long time and some money. And research. But I think really trying to focus on that a lot more. And then I'm writing alongside of that. There's absolutely a book's worth of material in that. So that's not a short-term project, as I'm about to start a PhD, but that's for sure in my plans. So
that would be exciting. That'd be great.
And
very useful.
Apparently also, you know, sort of like archaeological, historical skincare retreats. So
yes. Honestly, though, I know you said it as a joke, but I feel like that would sell so much. I think I know, what's her name? Farrell Monaco, I think, who is a experimental archaeologist. She's a Roman archaeologist, but she also does like cookery retreats and stuff, because she does bread baking, and that's her research as well. But so she also does like bread baking retreats and everything. So,
I think if we did a whole bunch of things, like created a scent and maybe not put, I don't know if legally we can put things on our body, but like smell them and definitely do. Yeah. I mean, there's something there. That was one of the funniest things when I did the ancient Rome, the Ovid face mask, is that the comments were just like, can I come next time? Like, we should do this. Like, it was, people were very energized by it. So it was really fun.
I feel like it would definitely work. And you could make it experimental archaeology. It wouldn't just be people could be helping with research.
Yeah, sign them up.
Yeah, you heard it here, folks. We're going to have a tabletop book, and then you will be able to go on a retreat and do the recipes for yourself.
So much fun.
Thank you so much, Katie, for coming and chatting to me all about a wide range of topics. I feel we've covered. We've covered all kinds of different things. It's been really lovely having you, and I've learned a lot more about ancient skincare.
I'm so glad. Thanks for having me.
Skincare, I hope that all you listening as well also enjoyed this tea break. If you do, as always, please do like, follow, subscribe, etc. wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the rest of the shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode or about Kate's work in particular, you can find all of the links and contact information in the show notes. Bye, everyone. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.